History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you're ever a bored middle schooler, you're probably looking around on the walls in your classroom at anything that could distract you, and you may have looked at the map of the United States. I was in this situation a few times, and something I always noticed were the four corners, where Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah all meet together. And then I wondered, are there other places like that in the United States where four states meet together? And that wasn't exactly the case, especially not east of the Mississippi, where there are almost no straight lines to speak of when it comes to state borders. I mean, yeah, there's some, like between Mississippi and Alabama, but for the most part, it's all sorts of curvy, crazy lines. Well, this question isn't just speculation when you're bored in school, although that is something, but listener Michael asked me this question. Why are some states so nice and square on a map? More specifically, how did the New England colonies and later states end up shaped as they are? I know that Vermont's story is very interesting, and I'm wondering what led all those states to break up, considering they're often small size. Well, concerning shape state, it's an interesting question, because west of the Mississippi, most states have nice flat sides. I'm from the state of Iowa, the north and south is almost completely flat, and we're flanked by the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, which are natural boundaries. But if you go further east, the states start looking like misshapen kidneys. Especially New Jersey. And sorry about that, New Jersey, but it is what it is. And if you go into the old world of the Eastern Hemisphere, there are almost no straight lines between nations to be found. And that's only the case of their nations that essentially came into existence in the 20th century, like those in the Middle East, where Jordan has a few straight lines on its borders, especially on the desert where there are no natural barriers. But overall, straight lines on national borders in the old world are few and far between. Well, why is that? Well, first what I'm going to do in this episode is I'm just going to highlight some of the questions that Michael had, specifically the history of Vermont and its neighbor New Hampshire, on how it got the state borders that it did. But then I'm going to look on the broader questions of how states got their shapes. What determined this? Was it a cartographer going out and thinking from the perspective of space and looking down on a political map of the United States and making nice straight lines? Is it purely on physical borders where rivers are, or forests are, where the Grand Canyon is? Does it have to do with political concessions and arguments between groups of people, and these borders are hammered out by something that looks like a diplomatic treaty? How does this all happen? The answer to all those questions is yes. Borders are a complicated history, and they're shifting over time. Going back into the ancient past, there was nothing anything like agreed-upon borders that we understand today. There were borderlands, where the sovereignty of one area ends and another begins, but these areas aren't very clear, so you would have something kind of like a no-man's land, where you had to go in between these areas. There was really no security offered to you. They were very dangerous. There were transient peoples who spent their entire lives in these areas that weren't under any kind of official sovereignty. So the further you go back into the past, the trickier this question becomes, and we're going to look at those different aspects in this episode. Well, let's start off with Vermont. How did Vermont get its shape? Okay, fair question. Vermont had been part of the colony of New York before the Revolutionary War, but when the King of England ruled in favor of New York over land disputes, Vermonters declared themselves a republic in 1777. They were led by Ethan Allen, and the United States even tried to join the province of Quebec during the Revolution, but it was rejected. Vermont paid New York money to settle land claims after the Revolutionary War ended, and it was admitted to the Union in 1791. The border between Vermont and New Hampshire meanders along the Connecticut River, and this forms a big part of Vermont's eastern border. Its southern border with Massachusetts is basically a straight line on the 42nd latitude, and it's its shortest boundary. For New Hampshire, its border goes back to the 1620s when it was made a colonial settlement by land grants from the British monarchy. New Hampshire and Massachusetts had a number of disputes about the size and control of the region through the 1600s and 1700s, and this was settled by a decree by King George II in the 18th century. New Hampshire's border with Maine was decreed to run through the middle of the Piscataqua River in 1740, but it was in dispute until a 2001 Supreme Court ruling settled it. New Hampshire's border to the west with Vermont was decided in 1790 when the state agreed to allow Vermont to have all lands to the west of the Connecticut River, as Vermont was considering whether to join the United States, remain independent, or become a British colony. So these are a few cases where borders are determined by geographic features, sometimes by disputes with others, and they're only really settled by a decree by a sovereign. So those are the individual stories of how those two states got their shape. Now, concerning the broader issue of state shape in the United States, there's a book by Mark Stein called How the States Got Their Shapes, and he deals with more of the meta issues. States aren't comparable with European nations on how they got their shapes, but it's interesting to compare why borders in Europe are never, ever straight with the Western states that tend to have straight borders. The main reason comes down to this. States in the United States came into existence, recognized by the U.S. government, mostly in the 19th century, when they were sparsely populated, and it was possible for a central government, led by surveyors, to determine these borders so they could be neat and geometric, and they didn't just come into existence due to the happenstance of human activity over hundreds and thousands of years, like what happened in Europe. The features of states in the United States arose from a number of sources. The earliest of these came from the French and Indian War in the mid-18th century, which saw England and the colonists take territory around the Great Lakes from the French, and then take land from the French in the Louisiana Purchase. Further to the west, territory came from Spanish and then a newly independent Mexico. The border with Canada was agreed at the 49th parallel with the British in 1818. Later, the Dutch ceded their territory along the Hudson River, and the Spanish in the last of their territory in what is now Florida. There are some common themes that determine the shape of states, and one that comes up repeatedly is Congress's desire to create states of equal size. In the West, there are a set of states with the same height, 3 degrees, and width, 7 degrees. This concept extends to access to resources as well. So ports on the Great Lakes are shared among the surrounding states. A second big driving force of state borders was slavery. The Missouri Compromise placed a boundary at a latitude of 36.5 degrees below which slavery was allowed, and above it, it wasn't. This motivated boundaries of states and led to the battle in the 1850s to create an equal number of states above and below the line. Now, there are exceptions to this. Boston Corner looks like it should belong in Massachusetts, but it's actually New York State. This is because the terrain made access to Boston Corner from the rest of Massachusetts difficult. Inaccessibility led to isolation from authorities and then lawlessness, so states were willing to cede territory like this because they didn't want to have to deal with it. Whole states were sometimes created to address potential lawlessness. So when gold was discovered in what is now Idaho, it was thought to be too distant from Oregon to be ruled from there with the influx of gold miners. There was also a concern that they would displace coastal Oregonians from government. Sometimes a river made a good boundary, but when the river has tributaries, and that's when it became hard, especially when borders are defined with reference to headwaters, which are difficult to locate. And also, rivers meander, so a chunk of a state might find itself on the wrong side of a river when the river moved. In some cases, survey errors and mistakes in negotiations led to strange borders. So I said that there was a goal for states to be roughly equal in size, but there are exceptions like Texas and California. Why is that? Texas is always unique, but Texas for a brief period was an independent country, and when it joined the Union, it negotiated itself in, so it was irregular in how big it was. California formed with the influx of miners who came for gold, and the Union was more concerned that they join than try to enforce borders on the new state. The charters of original U.S. colonies that evolved into states typically gave them territories that stretched all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific, as if Virginia would stretch in this massive, massive, short, squat state that was about 2,000 or 3,000 miles wide. But this point was largely moot because colonies didn't have the wherewithal to maintain populations across this entire length. The British monarchies that granted these charters weren't necessarily consistent or well-advised, and sometimes boundaries were defined by headwaters, which are notoriously ill-defined. So it wasn't until later on when these vague definitions of what the colonies were, the states were hammered out. Mark Stein notes that there are other factors that dictate how shapes got their states. Other big influencers were the American Revolution, the construction of railroads, the 1808 proposal for the Erie Canal, and the political, as I mentioned earlier, controversies over the issue of slavery. The American Revolution, for example, helped to define the shapes of the original 13 colonies that became the New England states. Thomas Jefferson thought the states in the new Northwest Territory, between the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, should be approximately 2 degrees of latitude and then 4 degrees of longitude, or about 138 miles high by about 276 miles wide. Congress didn't use Jefferson's recommendation in the Northwest Territory, but it did use latitude and longitude to create states in similar shape and size in the western U.S. So that's why if you look at North and South Dakota and Wyoming and Colorado and Oregon and Washington on a map, they look pretty similar. They're all kind of rectangular shaped. They're about 7 degrees of latitude or about 483 miles wide. And Kansas and Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota are about 207 miles tall, or about 3 degrees of latitude. With the construction of cross-country railroads, shapes of states didn't matter, didn't depend as much on the routes of rivers. Instead, railroad routes began to shape where one state ended and another began. In a similar fashion, the Erie Canal also influenced the shape of states in the regions it traversed. Okay, so those are external factors that influence the shape of a state. Let's look at one case study and look at internal factors. And I'm going to use the example of Iowa because I am an Iowan. And as listeners know, I like to shoehorn it into discussions. And I should mention that because otherwise there's nothing particular about Iowa because each state has its own history of how things come into being, about how its borders come into being. So from the earliest years of the United States, Congress adopted a plan to admit Western states into the Union on a status equal to the original 13. The region first became a territory with limited government. Then, when the population reached 60,000, the legislature could submit to the voters, which were white males 21 years and older, a proposal to draft the state constitution and send to Congress with an application for statehood. After many false starts, a proposal for Iowa was approved in 1844, but it took 2 more years before Congress in Iowa could agree on terms of a constitution. Iowa borders weren't an issue at first. They weren't an issue of intense debate. Missouri had already been admitted as a state, so Iowa's southern border was established, or it seemed at the time, and the Mississippi River divided Iowa from Illinois and Wisconsin on the east, simple enough. The northern and western boundaries, though, didn't have fixed lines. The first territorial governor of Iowa, Robert Lucas, wanted Iowa to extend up to what is now Minneapolis and St. Paul. So in alternate history, Iowa is much bigger. The convention adopted the Lucas borders and sent them to Congress for approval. Then Iowa's admission became a subject of political bickering. Each state got 2 senators, and northern interests wanted to carve out western lands into many smaller states that wouldn't support slavery and cotton production. So northern senators wanted to reduce the size of new states on the northern prairies and Great Plains so that they could crowd out southern states and have more votes of them and sunset slavery in this way. The South wanted the opposite. They wanted big states from this region. Big states equals fewer senators. So southern senators would have supported this super Iowa. So when Iowa's constitutional proposal reached Congress, the northern small state interest redrew the western border. They didn't want it to be on the Missouri River, as Lucas had proposed, and where it is today, but on a line about 80 to 100 miles back to the east. And they also moved the northern border south from Lucas's original proposal. Well, Iowans didn't like the smaller size. When the proposal came back to Iowa voters, the measure failed. A compromise was reached, setting the borders as we know them today, with the Missouri River to the west, and then Iowa's border, which is by driving a couple of hours south of the Twin Cities. The Constitution said the Iowa southern border is the northern border of Missouri, but it was unclear where that line was to be drawn. The survey line ran from the Missouri River to a point, quote, on the rapids of the Des Moines River, but there were several sets of rapids that met this description. There was a heated exchange between the governors of Iowa and Missouri, which led to the assemblage of militias on both sides. Imagine people picking up weapons over a state border. But there were never any shots fired, and the issue is settled by the U.S. Supreme Court. And this issue, things are still a little bit murky, because the Missouri River occasionally shifts its flow somewhat, although thanks to the Army Corps of Engineers, this happens a lot less than it used to, and lands on either side might find themselves on the opposite side. So does that mean that residents now vote on in a different state and pay different tax rates? The courts have been able to settle these issues. And the U.S. map would look much different in the Midwest if either the first Iowa boundary lines had been adopted. You could have had an Albert Lea, Iowa, which is now in southern Minnesota, and part of Minnesota's capital would have been in the Hawkeye State. But Council Bluffs and Sioux City, the Atlantic, and Storm Lake would have been part of Nebraska. Most listeners are hearing this and probably thinking, I don't care, that means absolutely nothing. But Nebraska and Iowa listeners are listening to that with utter horror. So such is Midwestern life when you really take a lot of stake in the fate of a small town or a mid-sized town with a population of 50 to 100,000 people. And if you're really curious what these things sounded like at the time, here are excerpts from the Act of Congress to define Iowa's boundaries on August 4th, 1845. This is what it sounds like in original writings. Beginning in the middle of the main channel of the Mississippi River, at a point due east of the middle of the mouth of the main channel of the Des Moines River, thence up the main of the main channel of the said Des Moines River to a point on said river where the northern boundary line of the state of Missouri, as established by the Constitution of that state, adopted June 12, 1820, crosses the said middle of the main channel of the said Des Moines River, thence westwardly along the said northern boundary line of the state of Missouri, as established at the time aforesaid, until an extension of said line intersect the middle of the main channel of the Missouri River, thence up the middle of the main channel of the said Missouri River to a point opposite the middle of the main channel of the Big Sioux River, according to Nicollet's map, this is an older surveyor's map, thence up the main channel of the said Big Sioux River, according to said map, until it is intersected by the parallel of the 43 degrees and 30 minutes north latitude, thence east along said parallel of 43 degrees and 30 minutes, until said parallel intersect the middle of the main channel of the Mississippi River, thence down the middle of the main channel of said Mississippi River to the place of beginning. So if that sounds really dizzying to you, you could look at a map of Iowa and follow what's being said. And what's interesting is that if a modern border were being described today in a political body, they would be using GPS coordinates so that it would be more decipherable to a computer than a human. That's how we know exactly what they're talking about. And we're not getting into arguments about, well, okay, well, what are the rapids of the Des Moines River? There's rapids up here. There's rapids 50 miles south. What are we talking about? And different parties would argue based on what they would stand to gain by it. So there's specific terminology in some places when they're talking about the parallel of 43 degrees and 30 minutes north latitude. All right, that's pretty exact scientific surveying language, about as exact as you can get in the 19th century. But then they're just talking about where one river begins and another river ends, and it's all about banks of rivers. It sounds like what a chronicler would describe in the Ottoman Empire in the 1600s when he's crossing the Tigris River, or when a political statesman is talking in the 1500s where they're working out a treaty between the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, saying that the bandits will be dealt with on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And it's very, very vague language. So the 1800s are interesting because it's not quite out of this pre-modern period completely. We're entering the modern period, but it's not completely there yet. So borders are kind of a fuzzy thing then.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
All right, so let's take another example of how it seems like when you move west, things become a lot more sharply defined and there's straight lines, but out east is it? A few years ago, I was following state elections in Georgia, and there was a map that showed counties in the American state of Georgia. And I was shocked because they looked so strange. They were all these amoeba-shaped blobs compared to counties in Iowa where they're very cleanly defined. They all look like squares or rectangles. Why do Georgia's counties look so strange? Georgia has 159 counties. That is a lot of counties. Most states don't have nearly that many counties. One story that often comes up is that Georgia's counties were designed so that farmers and mule-drawn wagon could get to the courthouse and back within the course of a day. So by that logic, counties would have to be small, and Georgia, being a pretty big state, had to create a lot of them. Some history professors think that's an apocryphal story. Glenn Eskew, a history professor at Georgia State University, said that he never saw any law in the state code that stipulated that. But even if it's not true, the mule-drawn wagon explanation tells us about where many of the state's counties were created, because the population was rural and spread out. And by having a structure of the county government, you were able to connect with the dispersed rural population with some government entity. But another reason that Georgia has so many of the counties is that rural Georgia was able to control the state. There was a political system taking shape in the late 1800s called the county unit system. The way it worked was that candidates in Georgia won not by number of votes, but by number of counties that they carried. So there was a saying back in the old days in the county unit system that pine trees counted more than people when it came to electing a governor. That's because counties had a set amount of votes, almost regardless of population, and that meant that more counties equaled more power. So as the county unit system went into place, lawmakers created more counties, a couple dozen, so that by the 1930s, rural counties outnumbered urban ones 15-1. And that's why for years, rural counties dominated both the legislature and the governor's office. And so as you can see, the same logic that went into northern and southern senators trying to create more or fewer states in different geographies led to Georgia creating more counties. So this is where politics affects how boundaries come into existence. So one last thing I'll touch on in this episode is I mentioned borders in ancient times, how there weren't militarized borders between nation states in the past. There were borderlands. There were gray zones where one empire or one kingdom ended and another one began. Borders were often gray zones between fortified cities and towns, which clearly belonged to certain nations. In a case where there were clear borders, it was something along the lines of a mountain or a river or a wall, like Hadrian's Wall or the Great Wall of China. In cases where both sides were full civilizations in that sense, the two sides often had treaties defining it as such. But in many cases of early civilizations like China, neighbors could be nomadic tribes. And what did a border mean to them if you're always on the move? In that case, there was plenty of raiding across borders. And borders didn't have much of a meaning in the case of a state where there weren't that many citizens. Most nations had no concept of citizen. Rome did have a definition, but a citizen wasn't something that you defaulted into. It was a very special class of people. Some residents on border regions might have governments trying to collect both governments trying to collect taxes from them. Others, if they were mobile enough, could completely avoid taxes. But for the most part, the idea of citizen wasn't clearly determined. Being a subject wasn't clearly determined, so you could sort of escape sovereignty in that way. But really, in the ancient past, outside of large empires, the most recognizable form of government to people was a city-state, where just a single city had sovereignty. You would have city walls, and the reason those walls were there was in order to instill sovereignty. Outside those walls, there really wasn't any sovereignty, and it was very difficult to project power that a king could do, or whatever passes a king. The Greek city-states, like Athens or Sparta, recognized a shared cultural heritage, but typically large cities were independent from any larger government. They could rule over smaller vassal states and almost treat them like slave states. But the boundaries of most city-states were defined by a wall and just beyond into the farmlands which supported the city's inhabitants. Egypt started out with city-states like these, but became a kingdom through various military actions, and this was divided to Upper and Lower Egypt, which was then unified by a single pharaoh, and this is how it remained throughout much of Egypt's dominance. But really, outside of the floodplain of the Nile, and once you get into the desert, the sovereignty of Egypt dissolves. So ancient Egypt's boundary was basically the Nile flood basin and where there was thick population. Out in the desert, that's where Egypt's sovereignty ended, so that was an informal boundary. When empires became more common, like the Roman Empire, the easiest means of governance was to keep a local authority in place, but make it answerable to the emperor. Rome was one of these city-states, but as it extended its influence outward in support of itself, it created an empire of other individual states under Roman control. Rome allowed these states to maintain their own political system, but it was secondary to Roman rule. The Roman border was the boundary around the seven hills within the city wall, And the Roman Empire was not Rome itself, but rather Roman-controlled, kind of like a country that was invaded militarily. So, for example, Iraq after the Second Gulf War was occupied by the U.S. military, but it was never seen as being American. But even Rome, I mean, its boundaries were mostly defined by geographic features. It was the Atlantic Ocean to the west, the Rhine and Danube rivers to the north and east, and then North Africa and the Sahara Desert to the south. There's discussion forums I've seen on Reddit or Quora where people ask, why didn't Rome conquer sub-Saharan Africa? And really, why on earth would you? It would be so difficult to go into that terrain, and the Sahara Desert made such a natural border that there'd be no reason to go further south. And natural borders just made sense to people in the ancient past, of borders found by natural features. And lastly, borders could sometimes come about by funny reasons. For example, if you wonder why Brazil, one of the few places in Latin America that doesn't speak Spanish but speaks Portuguese, that has to do with the Treaty of Tordesillas that was mediated by the Pope very shortly after the discovery of the New World by Columbus. That's where Spain and Portugal, that were the naval superpowers of the time, they agreed in the treaty to divide the world between them, the New World as they understood it, where the West went to Spain and the East went to Portugal. The idea is that all of the land that was west of the meridian, 370 degrees west of the Cape Verde Islands, would go to Spain, and they thought that all of the lands of the New World were located here, and that everything east would go to Portugal, which was the African coast. But what they didn't know is that if you went further down the south of South America, there was Brazil. So Portugal used this technicality to colonize Brazil without violating the treaty, while Spain controlled all the rest of the Americas. And there you go. All right, well, that is an exploration of how different places, different states, different nations get their borders. Very complicated history, but a lot of fun to explore. So thanks for the question, John, and I'll see y'all in the next episode. I think that covers it. That's all I have for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.